Well, before I forget, let me just say right out of the box on Coast to Coast AM, a shout out to Chris in Ottawa, Madison Clan, Nick, Alexandria, Wendy, just some of the people with whom I have been corresponding on Facebook. Well, I got a few spaces left before I fill up my quota of friends, apparently. We only get 5,000 friends on our page, so if you wanted to friend me, our opportunity is dwindling. Also, while I'm giving a shout-out, how about to El Paso's finest, the first responders, all the firefighters who keep El Paso from becoming El Fuego, especially fire station number 6, the linchpin in the El Paso firefighter system. It all hinges on fire station number 6. And it all depends on you tonight, too. This is one of those amazing shows for me that I get to learn during. I get to find out new things coming up next hour from somebody that experienced something that I would have paid cash money to witness, and that would be the Phoenix Lights. Not every station along the Coast to Coast network carries the Art Bell Somewhere in Time Best of series. A lot of stations do, so it's kind of a great recap on some of the terrific shows that Art Bell has had over the years on Coast to Coast. And it was not by accident that tonight on the Somewhere in Time show, they broadcast Art Bell's first that I know of, 1997 Phoenix Lights show. I missed it, so I didn't hear. I know that there was a show with people originally calling in, and then there was this one. I don't think it was the same show. I think this one was from May, and we're just coming up on the 13th anniversary of the Phoenix Lights, and that happened in March, right? March 13th. And tonight, about an hour from now, we'll be talking with one of the many credible witnesses of something which has yet to be explained. It perhaps was some things, depending on with whom you speak, different sightings in slightly different places, but generally over the Phoenix metropolitan area. And one of the people that would have seemingly the most to lose by putting her credibility on the line is a medical doctor who has been yet one of the strongest, most vocal advocates for discovering the truth of what happened over Phoenix. She does not accept any of the government explanations. We'll talk about it with her coming up next hour. She says that she was a skeptic. She is now a believer. And along with many other very credible, established pillars of the Arizona community, they're standing by their story of what they saw. And she'll talk about it coming up next hour on Coast to Coast. Also, you might remember Charles Pellegrino was just on a few weeks ago, and he talked about Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but really ultimately just focusing on Hiroshima, with the research that was done for this fabulous new book called The Last Train from Hiroshima. And I've always admired his work. I find him to be one of my favorite guests on Coast to Coast. Very gracious guest, always willing to be challenged and to engage with you all on the phones in ways that not every guest can. He's just always been the kind of guy that whenever we get a chance to put him on the air, we'll take advantage of that. But he's run into some problems with this book. And he has, he's as of last report, his publisher has withdrawn support for the book Last Train from Hiroshima. Henry Holt and Company said it would stop shipping and printing copies of Charles Pellegrino's nonfiction account of the World War II mission to drop an atomic bomb on Hiroshima and of the bombing's victims. That decision came after, and I'm reading from a New York Times account here, after problems with one of the sources for the book, who is characterized as a substitute flight engineer on the mission, who appears to have been an imposter who fooled Charles Pellegrino. But that isn't the end of the problem with the book. The university that Charles Pellegrino had always said had awarded him a PhD and then stripped him of that title issued a statement late Thursday saying it utterly rejects his claims as baseless and defamatory. And Charles Pellegrino has something to say about both of those news stories from this week, and he'll do it next live on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Well, Charles Pellegrino, it's been a tough week, I know, for you. Let me just start off by saying, I hope everybody's okay. I understood there was a little car accident or something tonight. Is everybody all right?
Yeah, it was a bit of a fender bender.
Okay.
So everyone's all right.
Okay. Well, thank you for making time for us still, despite all that's going on with you. Nice to know that at least your friend James Cameron is standing by you. Is it all right if I start our time together by reading that quote from him?
Okay.
James Cameron, it says here from the New York Times, nobody ever said James Cameron changes his mind easily. And now Mr. Cameron, the Avatar and Titanic filmmaker, says he still plans to produce a movie about the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, even though a book about the subject that he has optioned has been withdrawn by the publisher. He goes on to say, all I know is that Charlie would not fabricate. So there would be no reason. There must be a reason for this misunderstanding. And so I guess that brings us to exactly what is the misunderstanding these days, Charles Pellegrino, about the book Last Train from Hiroshima, which we loved talking to you about a couple of weeks ago.
Right. Well, it began when Bill Broder of the New York Times called me, the guy I trust. I've sailed with him. I know he does some very good in-depth scientific reporting. And he called, hard to believe it's only 2 weeks ago. It feels like months ago. And told me that basically there were two first-hand eyewitness participants from the plane Necessary Evil. One of them was the navigator who would have been sitting right across from Joe Fuoco if Joe Fuoco had been in the man in that seat.
Now, explain just real quickly, we're talking about the chase plane or the plane before the Enola Gay?
It was one of the planes that went with the Enola Gay. It was the scientific photographic plane.
And they would have been there as the bomb dropped. And Joseph Fuoco is a guy that you had interviewed for Last Train from Hiroshima and had given you information that is part of what made it's very interesting and it was very informative for you, correct?
Yes, and he also had information that seemed to connect a few of the dots that really didn't sit with something, a mystery that had surrounded the little boy bomb. It fit into those missing pieces a little too well. It's something that should never have happened, actually. And
what do you mean by that, Charles?
The guy was very, very believable. He had all the photographs. He had photographs of him under the nose art of one of the planes that's disputed now, the plane Bad Penny. He had the marker down at the end of the runway at Tinian Island. It's the same guy in the photos that's in the photos of his wedding a year later. Even a letter from President Truman that was displayed at his funeral.
Now, where did you meet this guy, Joseph Fuoco, that you used as a source for your book?
A friend who's a history buff knew him, a very, very bright guy, very trusted guy. The firefighters all knew him. He was a firefighter himself at one point. So it was hard to imagine that a veteran and a firefighter would make this up. I didn't carry the usual level of skepticism, for example, that for Nurse Nancy Cantwell, I met her in New York. When I went over to Japan, I met the other nurses that she had worked with at a Hiroshima rescue station, and they had pictures of her when she was a young woman and all this, and all of that was double and triple verified, but his story fit in with things that Charles Sweeney had said to me. And another thing was it was a little more difficult because I had started trying to interview people about 1999, And at that time, Charles Sweeney was about the only person who would speak with me about writing a book on this subject. And he was very suspicious that I was going to be calling them war criminals or what have you.
Right.
And most of his conversation was about defending the mission. And of course, anyone who reads the book and reads the way that I wrote about these guys knows that that really wasn't a necessary fear.
No.
As a matter of fact, my father was training to go into mainland Japan. He was part of the 82nd Engineer Battalion. There were maybe about a dozen of the 300 people he started with still left alive, and he was certain he wasn't going to survive Japan.
Right, a lot of people felt that way.
Yeah, the 509th, when you get right down to bottom, those guys saved my dad's life, and we wouldn't be here having this conversation.
So, same thing for my uncle as well. So, the story is then you got in contact with this guy, Joseph Fuoco. You met with him, and as you say, he seemed so credible from the get-go, from his reputation as a firefighter, being a veteran, having the photographs, having this letter from Truman. And so you kind of let your guard down, that you might have been more critical, you might have double-checked some sources that you didn't in his case. And instead you felt like, oh, I have a find here.
And
because
there were no inconsistencies. That was the other, right? You know, I had run into Hiroshima survivors or alleged Hiroshima survivors, and you run into inconsistencies.
Sure.
Very few people are good enough liars that they can remember everything they say. And I believe I ran into someone who might have begun this story as a mean-spirited person over 60 years ago. But I would say by a half century or so ago, he was believing it, that this had become his reality. And by the time I met him, he had evolved into this person where you couldn't imagine anything mean-spirited in him. If you saw at his funeral, the honor guard of police and firefighters and military by the hundreds.
So he really, Joseph Fuoco was a veteran. He was in the South Pacific. He was near, perhaps, where they were launching the planes, perhaps served on another plane. But he did not serve on the plane Necessary Evil. He did not fly the mission that day over Hiroshima.
Well, when you have two firsthand eyewitness participants, one of whom said that if it was Joe Fuoco, I could have reached across and shaken his hand, the man who was in the flight engineer's seat. And he said, and that man in that seat was Mr. Corliss, not Fuoco.
Right.
And when you have two people on the same plane who are still alive who say that, that trumps all other evidence.
So the letter, the photographs, you talked to, what was the information that you got from Joseph Fuoco, errant as it may be, what was the information that you got from him that you used so crucially in Last Train from Hiroshima?
Actually, there was one story on why he seemed to have the explanation, which also tied in with something Chuck Sweeney had said. Chuck Sweeney had said that before they left, Luis Alvarez had inserted these polonium plugs, three more polonium plugs that were the world's last of the supply. I think that might be something that Chuck Sweeney was misremembering, that he was thinking of the plugs that had been put in not 2 days before, but almost a week before.
Why would that matter?
It hadn't been touched. Because
explain
if
why
they had
that
been
matters.
Put in 2 days before, that fit in with what Joe Fuoco said, that there had been an accident 2 days before, and that Alvarez had put these last plugs into the bomb in order to work. Kind of like what these plugs were was they were sort of like injecting nitrous oxide into an engine to make it burn hotter.
Right.
And Fuoco had said the bomb had been compromised in some way, and that seemed to make sense, too, because years and years earlier, Harold Urey had said the bomb had only gone off with about half the amount of matter converted to energy in the reaction zone as he had believed should have gone off.
So it because
that was about 1979 that he had said that. So we had this mystery of a bomb that was a much lower yield than it should have been.
This led to you, as you described it in the book, or what? How other people described it as sort of a dud, that it did not go off at the level that it should have gone off. Do you believe now then that that there is no scientific proof of that claim, or there's no substantiation?
Well, people have expressed an opinion that the bomb was a dud compared to how powerful it should have been. People have been expressing that opinion for about 30 years that I've heard of, and actually it's argued. Some believe it was a dud, some believe it wasn't a dud. It was lower power than it should have been. That was always a bit of a mystery to me. Joe Fuoco seemed to connect a few of the dots. There's a chance he might be right, but every observation, even any opinion he had, I really have to remove as fruit of the poison tree. If he was not in that seat.
Right. If he was not on the scientific plane, the chase plane, necessary evil the day it took off for Hiroshima. So
I am very, very sorry to every member of the 509th. I mean, I cannot apologize enough to those guys.
Have you talked to anybody else who has said to you, oh, I can't believe you got fooled by this imposter, or, we understand? Have you gotten any feedback at all from any of the remaining living members of that team that flew over Hiroshima?
I've heard feedback secondhand, and okay. I've heard from a friend who contacted them, and a week ago they wanted to burn the book, but he's spoken with them, and they've cooled down a bit, and now I hear they don't quite want to burn the book, maybe rip it up. They don't quite want to hold a bonfire, but actually with the way things are going now, this is kind of with the book not going out in hardcover, with this thing repeated over and over, it's one of the outcomes I wanted. I wanted to be out there, hopefully as a corrected ebook edition as soon as possible.
Now, I will tell you again, and I said this to you that night, and I think you're a fabulous writer. I think your research, in this case here, by your own admission, you know, you're saying you're struggling with this part, you got fooled, you regret what happened. But generally speaking, I mean, you write with such detail, and everything is sourced, and there's just a ton of follow-up information in every one of your books, and I so much enjoy what you do. But that having been said, as of last report, the publisher has spiked the book, and they are not going to print any more of it, or now are they saying that we're going to sort this out and come back to it, or where does it stand?
Well, we had a very big, big disagreement about one of the priests in the book, who is someone who is still alive, who we just could not resolve that.
This is one of the priests that you mentioned as having been a survivor on the day he was on the ground.
Well, more than that, there's Father McQuitty, who, if you go to my other things I've written in Return to Sodom and Gomorrah, for example, he's in the acknowledgments, and I point out his name has been changed. In writing the acknowledgments in this book as an oversight, I had just forgotten to put that parenthetical statement around Father McQuitty and Father Matthias.
Okay. And now this is we'll get back to this, because this is important too, that because these priests on the ground, they also tell an amazing story, and so I want to get back to that coming up. And then of course the other issue that came up was the subject of your credentials, and
the ad hoc tribunals.
I hope we can get another show, but
we'll get into it.
Let's get into this again. We're just trying to at least understand where we stand with this terrific book and one of our favorite guests, Charles Pellegrino. The book is Last Train from Hiroshima. Knowing now what you're hearing, that there's a problem with a source in the book, and that the publisher has spiked it because of that. I would still tell you it's a great read. I'd still say just ignore that part, but it's really just it's an amazing book, and Charles does such a millisecond by millisecond accounting of what happened at Hiroshima from the second, from the fraction of a second that the bomb first went off. You will finally understand why these bombs are so devastating, why we should try to put ourselves in a world where that never happens again, but actually what happened on that day. And so we'll talk about the credential issue coming up too, then after the bottom of the hour. And then the Phoenix Lights, top of the hour, the medical doctor who said she was once a skeptic, she is no longer. She's a true believer. She lived it. She'll talk about it on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Well, I haven't got the blog up yet, but I will before the end of this hour. In fact, I'll include a link for that song, Danny Gokey from American Idol. That song came out on my birthday, and it's just sort of perfect, actually, earlier in the week. My best days are ahead of me. I hope you feel that way, too, in your life. And I hope that that Charles Pellegrino does, too, although it's been a tough week for him. His book, The Last Train from Hiroshima, has made headlines, both for its terrific reviews originally and then for the questioning of its science and its sources. It's taken a couple of tough hits, and then suddenly the publisher spiked the book. We were just getting to that part about whether or not the book will, what form will the book appear in after he edits out the material from the imposter who sold him on the idea that he was sitting there on the scientific chase plane. And then we'll talk about the priests that get mentioned in the book and why that's a problem for the publisher, and Dr. Charles Pellegrino's title, doctor, and exactly what that is about coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Well, again, Charles Pellegrino, the author of Last Train from Hiroshima, responsible for books like The Ghosts of the Titanic, what was it, Ghosts of Vesuvius, Charles? I'm trying to remember all of the books I have of yours. And in this case, the Last Train from Hiroshima was getting terrific reviews, and deserves them, too, for bringing a scientist's eye to the events of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And the book had already been optioned by his friend James Cameron, already talking about the next project after Avatar. It was all very hopeful, but then suddenly this. So the publisher and you are in a disagreement about the priests. Explain the role of the priests in the telling of the story. What did they bring to the table for Last Train from Hiroshima?
Well, there was one priest who is approximately two pages in the book. He was one of the ant walkers, and he was one of the people who came across this burned-out trolley car. Most importantly, he had described to me the three children, and at this time, he was already an alcoholic by about 1974 when I met him, and he could not get over these three children that he had seen on top of a pinnacle of bricks, which had been part of the side of a building at one point. They were either two or three stories up, bleeding badly, crying, and he was just in a daze, and he kept walking, and then he turned around near where a bunch of people were walking toward this trolley car that was all burned and the people inside were carbonized. And then he started thinking of the children. He could never find his way back toward them, and he was walking in a daze for I don't know how long. But years and years later, all he could think about was these three children that he felt he had abandoned, that he might have helped.
And the ant walkers, to explain the ant walkers, he was one of the ant walkers, but for people that didn't hear that show, it's a beautiful image, but it's sad and tragic, but fascinating at the same time.
It was these people who were following each other in rows, sometimes over hills of rubble, just mindlessly following one after another, where there would be a sidewalk or a paved road nearby. And yet they would be going over just one person blindly following the other. And if one person broke off from the others, sometimes some of those would follow that person on. And it was something that went on for days and days. Minami, who is a nurse who came to America and is now named Nancy Cantwell. She described the last of them that she saw, where they were walking by the rescue station, completely unaware at that point of who they were 2 or 3 days later. And their muscles were exposed. They weren't bleeding blood. They were bleeding what appeared to be water where the muscles were exposed. And Dr. Fuji had stayed with her for a while until she was assured that these ant walkers, the last of them, were in not pain, that they weren't even in this world in their minds. One of the more horrifying sights that she had seen. So this priest had become one of them, only he was not as severely injured with his muscles exposed. We wouldn't have had his story in the 1970s otherwise.
Right.
Now, another priest I knew, who is a priest who is under a pen name in all of my books. So you go back to other accounts, he said, we had an agreement from 1990. You can quote me accurately, you can describe what I do, but never, my name must always remain secret to you. And as I said, as an oversight, I forgot in this one book, I forgot to put that parenthetical statement in the acknowledgments. And he had an unusual, and something I very much admired, a compassion for the families and friends of suicides. And it turned out that the one I call Father Matthew, Father Matthias, he had died by suicide eventually about 1986. And this priest was involved with other priests in where he was buried on consecrated ground. Father McQuitty had said, oh, it was Hiroshima that killed him and these things that he could not get past from Hiroshima.
Right.
He said the same thing about a very, very good friend of mine who was dying of a terrible disease and ended it early. And she was also buried on consecrated ground. And he had presided over her funeral and said the same thing. It was the disease that killed her. He was involved also when there were controversies over whether people who jumped from the Twin Towers as they were burning, whether or not they were suicides, which just seemed ridiculous to me,
right.
And it should seem ridiculous to everyone else that these were suicides.
Right.
And there were arguments over whether they could be buried on consecrated ground. But in any case, I could not reveal the name of this priest, and it probably wouldn't have been a problem if not for that oversight that I had the usual parenthetical statement, Father
right.
McQuitty is, his name
not
has
his real
been
name.
Changed.
Right.
The publisher was demanding then his real name because the AP, the Associated Press, wanted his real name. I contacted him. I asked him if I could have his permission. The question itself was heartbreak to him. And he's a very elderly man. He depends on the church for basically his medical care. They take a vow
sure.
of poverty.
Sure.
And he said, I cannot be drawn into this vortex, not at my age. And I promised that I would always keep his name secret then.
When he passes on, will you be able to use his name and exonerate at least
I never
that
thought
piece?
That what I said and what I was writing in this book would, as has been pointed out to me, it would bring into question possibly every burial he has been in any way participant in. So I don't know. I don't know.
You don't know if you can. Okay,
I don't know. I would have to know that graves aren't going to get dug up if his
right.
name is ever revealed.
Right.
And that's the one, he's only in one sentence in the entire book, and it became this huge thing.
Well, so but it became this huge thing because, as you mentioned, an imposter had fooled you on his participation. You didn't vet him well enough, and he got into the book, and the fruit of the poison tree is such that the publisher has spiked it. So they won't be publishing any more versions of this book?
Not this publisher. It may come out in paperback. When
a corrected
out,
version
my
in paperback.
The publisher was in a war with Amazon Kindle over the Kindle program, and it was. I had suggested, you know, an easy solution to this is the technology. As long as they've got Amazon Kindle can with a reasonable assurance say that this is piracy resistant, you know, that there's that they can do that, I would say we could have a corrected edition of the book. I told them we could have a corrected edition of the book out in a month. And right. That wouldn't that be what some of the people in the book, Mr. Yamaguchi and these people who survived the double bombings and became, right. You know, went from Hiroshima to Nagasaki and right. Survived that. If he could become a man who built bridges, wouldn't it be good to, wouldn't he want us to do that? And I think I was looked at as kind of naive, and it was just shaking right. Heads, and it was like, are you nuts? Well, now Amazon Kindle, my publisher's enemy, the enemy of my enemy is my
is
friend.
Right, is your friend. Well, I do want, and I mean, it sounded, may have sounded awkward when I said beautiful images, but you made, you brought it real. You made the humanity of that day so vivid, and that I'll never forget the ant walkers and how they were they just kind of banded together in that, in their the sort of days for survival. But let's go back to your the issue of your credentials, because I know that, having spoken to you before, that you went to school where you were pursuing your PhD in Brisbane, correct?
No, in Victoria University of Wellington in New Zealand.
One
thing that's happened during the last week is a lot of New Zealanders have been coming forth, some of whom were students when I was there, who were through the same thing with this war between that involved evolution. That's the one thing
you're gonna have to explain.
Of us have in common.
You're jumping ahead here a little bit for people that don't know. So you had said that you had a PhD that had been conferred upon you, but that had been withdrawn.
Retroactively revoked. Yes.
Okay. You say that, but the university, in a statement that was published earlier in the week, said following complaints. Dr. Pellegrino submitted a thesis which, in the unanimous opinion of the examiners, was not of a sufficient standard for a PhD to be awarded. That, according to the Vice Chancellor of Victoria University of Wellington, she went on to say that following complaints from Pellegrino, an investigation was carried out by the university in 1986. Pellegrino appealed to Her Majesty the Queen. The case was then considered by the Governor General, who disallowed your appeal. And so it says here, Charles Pellegrino was never awarded a PhD from Victoria. Explain then how you could be right, or how you could both be right in this.
Well, actually, I had sat my thesis dissertation in August of 1981, had passed my dissertation with flying colors. It was actually being taught in the chemistry department of that university, the methods section of my thesis, and the method that's been used all around the world ever since for measuring the surface areas of irregularly shaped objects. The thesis was published in the field's leading peer review scientific journal. Where I got into trouble was what I did after I passed my thesis dissertation, and I started an excavation in Amberley, a fossil site in New Zealand, and I was following work at that time that was very controversial. It was called punctuated equilibrium theory, and there were a few other tongue twisters like that in there, things that were very controversial in 1982 and 83, but by 1990 had become old hat, literally. So what happened was I was called to a meeting, and I was told I will stop this work. I will withdraw my book with Dr. Stoff, Darwin's Universe, from publication or else. And it got very bad. My two laboratories were dismantled. A lot of bad things happened, and I left the country and picked up, came to the United States, then found out I was retroactively being put on trial. Only it was an ad hoc tribunal in which I was not allowed to participate or to have any kind of representation whatsoever on my part. None whatsoever. prominent scientist, not only in the United States, but in New Zealand, came in on my side protesting this. And it turned out I was not the only student this was being done to. What we did have in common is we were all working in some area of the field of evolutionary biology, which in some quarters became a very hot word at that time.
So it just to understand it, so the university says that you were never awarded a PhD. You still insist that you had passed your work and had
When they say, when the vice chancellor says that I never sat a dissertation and passed my PhD and got my PhD, she's very much mistaken, in at least insofar as the truth is concerned. That's the kindest way I can put it.
Okay. So on the main, in the end, you will then continue to call yourself doctor, or how will you modify that to not make that be an issue?
Well, actually, right now there is a real investigation going on in New Zealand. There were more people than me who were brought before the ad hoc tribunals and who had their degrees downgraded or revoked, and in their cases, it was all temporary. About 1995. Actually, a little before that, their degrees had, everyone else had went through this, everything was kind of fixed up, and a professor of mine, who was a defender of mine, wrote to find out why mine hadn't been officially restored, and he was told basically Pellegrino made a stink, and if he hadn't made a stink about it and written about it on his website and written about it in articles and written about it in the SFWA bulletin and even in his novel Flying to Valhalla, well, maybe it would have gone a little easier for him. And okay, for more than a decade, it's been on my website where under the biography section where I talk about all this. And I said that my response to that was, well, it might have gone a little easier for Rosa Parks if she had done what she had told and just quietly gone to the back of the bus, but I'm an American, and that's the way we do things in America. We make a stink.
So,
and what we did, we really made a stink. The thing was, a lot of my colleagues here in the United States, knowing this story, they said, you need to get it in writing, what they did to you. You need to get the proof.
Okay.
And fortunately, they were willing to write back to me snarky letters to everything I wrote to them. And after numerous times, we had the university saying, yes, he met the requirements for the PhD. Yes, he met it. Yes, okay, the thesis was published. Yes, it was for all the requirements of the PhD. But we cannot look at the merits of his work. All we're looking at is the ad hoc tribunal's power to retroactively revoke degrees. And everyone from Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute to Brookhaven Labs to NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory, once they said, that proof is your diploma. That once they said you passed your degree and the merits of your work are irrelevant, and all we're looking at is people we put in authority to take your degree away, that's all the proof you need.
All right. Well, then we know where we stand. And so we continue to think of you in that way. We know that whatever happens with the text and in what other form it comes out in, last train from Hiroshima is probably still going to see the big screen someday with James Cameron. Is that the plan still?
That's the plan eventually, but you never know how long it takes.
Of course.
Look at Avatar. That was something that he first wrote the screen treatment in 1995 while he was on his way to the Titanic.
Right. So thank you, Charles. Thank you for explaining that. Glad to have that moment to figure that all out with.
Yeah, I think one analogy to look at that as is a guy I knew, Senator Matsunaga, who was Japanese ancestry and was put in one of the internment camps in his youth. And it's just imagine if 25 years later, someone in the press came forth and said, oh, you have a criminal history. You were in an internment camp and we're going to judge that as somehow right.
Okay. Charles Pellegrino, always a pleasure. Good to talk to you. Glad we can help set the record straight for last train from Hiroshima. And I hope next week is better than the last two that you've had.
Oh, I sure do hope so.
Okay. I know you're looking to turning the corner. Coming up, Dr. Lynn Kitai, internationally acclaimed physician, health educator, and witness to the Phoenix Lights. And no matter how much pressure she's under, she still says, "I know what I saw," next on Coast to Coast.